My name is Adam. I am an alcoholic.
I am.
I want to first thank you for inviting me to come talk tonight. It's an honor and a privilege to be asked to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. Ultimately, it's a responsibility to give back what was so freely given to me. Welcome to all the people that are new. You know, if you're trying this again, or it's your first conference, or your sponsor made you come here tonight, or perhaps you don't want to be here. I didn't get to AA because I had a bad weekend. You know, I had a couple of bad decades. And for me, like a lot of us, eventually this becomes a matter of life and death. I mean, every meeting has their perpetual newcomer, especially in a smaller community. You know, you see that lost soul that takes chip after chip. And that was me. I stood up in the Los Angeles area as a newcomer for 17 years. I mean, it became ridiculous. I had so many chips and key tags. You know, I could have played poker with them. It's awful. I remember one secretary saying, give him back. You know, and I did that walk of shame over and over and over again. And, you know, looking back at that experience now as a newcomer, what I would do is I would go into your head and I would look back at myself and I would think, gosh, what a loser. Why can't you get this? What's wrong with you? And I know the old timers were judging me. You know, if you're new, we're judging. I mean, my home group makes bets. I'm not that spiritual. I mean, I love it when they say, don't judge anybody. You ever hear that? Don't judge anybody in AA. And then what do they tell you 5 minutes later? Stick with the winners. That's not confusing, right? I can remember sitting in the detox. I'm at this treatment center across this long desk from this drug and alcohol counselor, and he looks at me and he says, now, Adam, don't make any major changes in your first year. So I get out of treatment, I get to an AA meeting, I get a sponsor. What's the first thing he tells me? You got to change everything. Right? How about don't make any major decisions in your first year? Anybody seen the third step? How about don't get in a relationship in your first year? No one knows if that works. No one's ever done it. I always look for the people that aren't laughing, right? There's always a saint in the crowd. If you got a halo, don't let it choke you. But the one I love is God doesn't give us more than we can handle. If I really believe that, if God didn't give me more than I could handle, I wouldn't need God's help. And the longer I've been sober, the longer I've been separated from alcohol, the more I've eventually come to terms with the fact that I absolutely, desperately need God's help. I need your help. If you're new, help is the dirtiest four-letter word in AA. The hardest thing for many of us to do is to relinquish control, to admit defeat, to ask for help. And, you know, I thank God for the unconditional love of the old-timers. A lot of the old-timers that aren't with us anymore that said stuff to me like, you know what, don't even bother taking chips. Just sit in the back. Shut up. You know, in a loving way, right? But they also made it really clear to me, and if you're new, I hope you hear this. They made it really clear to me that if and when I was ready, because they could see it by my attitude, my lack of interest, my demeanor, my behavior, they could see that it wasn't right now. Those old-timers saw that. But those old-timers made it really clear to me that if and when I was ready, that the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous would always be open to a drunk like me. And I think looking back at that experience now, next to my parents, Alcoholics Anonymous is the closest thing to unconditional love that an alcoholic like myself will ever experience. No matter how many lives I destroyed, how many cars I wrecked, how many jobs I lost, how many hearts I broke, right? How many despicable, shameful things I did. And if you're a drunk, if you're an alcoholic like me, it's shameful to be the town drunk, to be the neighborhood alcoholic. The shame and degradation that comes with being an alcoholic, to wake up one more time or come to and do the nightly review, you know? Where was I? And get that horrific phone call. Or to watch that loving family that had saved for my college and had all those hopes and dreams for me, that dressed me and educated me and dropped me off at school, to watch those two beautiful people watch me burn my life to the ground, to the point where my mom eventually moved and didn't leave a forwarding address. Despite all of that, the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous has always been open to people like me. And I think if I lived to be 100 years old, I could never, ever pay AA back for the love and the kindness that you people have shown me. And I want to thank Don for all of his help and his hospitality, picking me up from the airport. And all that being said, now, eventually, as a newcomer, I started coming to meetings drunk. Now, the interesting thing about AA 2017, you see somebody drunk in an AA meeting these days, people say stuff like, "Oh my gosh, what's he doing here?" That's not irony, right? And I, you know, don't want to bash the therapeutic community, but, you know, because of this event called treatment, which is now a $35 billion a year industry, right? It's kind of grown up about AA. You know, it's up there with annuities in the Wall Street Journal. You don't see a lot of wet alcoholics in AA. Treatment kind of swoops us up in our most desperate moments, right? Throws us into yoga class. Craft hour. I'm making belt buckles and bongs, right? Nature walks. Now, there's a lot of young people here. There's a few, at least. And, you know, 30 years ago, there were not a lot of young people in AA. And I was 16, 17, 18 years old, coming in and out of AA. And, you know, the old timers would say stuff like, "You know what, kid, we spilled more than you drank." And we're like, "You know what, pops, we didn't spill any. That's why we got here sooner." But for 17 years, I'm recycling through the rooms. We have a chapter in the big book, the chapter to wives. I never got that far in the book, but if you're new and you get to the chapter to wives in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the chapter to wives talks about four specific types of alcoholics. It actually enumerates them, type 1, type 2, type 3. And the fourth type of alcoholic that's described in the chapter to wives is the type of alcoholic that's been placed in one institution after another, that typically drinks on his way home from the hospital. And in those 17 years that I recycled through the rooms, that is what I eventually became. By the time I finally got sober in AA, I'd gone through residential treatment for alcoholism 28 times. I know, not 28 days like the movie. This isn't Hollywood. 28 consecutive times, and I wore that like a badge of honor. I thought, you know, that's what made me an alcoholic. And I remember telling my sponsor, "Hey, you know, I went through treatment 28 times. I was hoping that would, like, get rid of the guy, you know, loser. Go find someone that's willing, you know, ruin his batting average." And he looks me right in the eye and he smiles and he says, "You know, going through treatment 28 times, that doesn't really make you an alcoholic." And I thought, "You're kidding." He said, "Oh, no, no, that just means you paid $500,000 for a big book." And I didn't think that was funny either. And I'm not going to start citing and quoting pages tonight out of the big book, but page 101 of the big book says, "Any scheme that attempts to shield the alcoholic from temptation is doomed to failure." See, treatment was a great place to fatten me up for another run, but treatment never solved the problem. And as an alcoholic, like so many of us, I always thought the problem was alcohol. I'd been hearing that since I was in eighth grade. "Why do you drink so much? Why are you always hungover in class? Why don't you just stop?" That's what the doctor's opinion calls frothy emotional appeal. It says it seldom suffices. And I always thought the problem was liquor. And I remember someone in AA saying to me, "Adam, if alcohol's your problem, that drink, that shot glass, that 12-pack, that little glass of Chardonnay, if that's your problem, you're probably not an alcoholic." And then in the very next breath, he says to me, "And if you are, in fact, an alcoholic, the type that's described in the doctor's opinion in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, your problem is an alcohol." And I remember thinking, what? It took me another decade to understand what he was trying to tell me. It was like some kind of cruel riddle. I drank over that for years. But when I got around a home group of big book literalists that started to take the statements in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, turn them into questions, and direct them at me, was I in incapable of being honest with myself. Did I in fact drink because I liked the effect produced? Was I restless, irritable, and discontent by nature? Was my greatest obsession that somehow, someday, I would control and enjoy my drinking at the same time, and so forth and so on? And as I went through those questions, I started to see the truth. And one of those truths I saw is that I was never able to live successfully with alcohol. Even as a teenager, I was peeing in my pants, drooling on my desk, passed out under the bleachers, always overshooting the mark. I mean, my nickname in junior high school was Space Cadet. I couldn't find homeroom. People are picking high schools, I'm picking rehabs, right? But see, if you're like me, alcoholism comes in people. It doesn't come in bottles or six-packs or wine glasses. And the greater aspect of this spiritual illness, as Bill Wilson describes it, centering in my mind, if it shows me anything at all, going through the considerations in the book, it shows me that an alcoholic of my type, this type, cannot live without alcohol. Not successfully, not happily. And part of what it actually means for me to be an alcoholic is I seem to have a mind that will continue to take me back to liquor. If I'm really honest about my relationship with booze, every time I get released from an emergency room, a hospital, central jail, what it means for me to be an alcoholic is I seem to have this mind that will consistently and continually lead me back to alcohol. It's almost like my default mode, like on a computer. And, you know, it was very interesting because I was sponsoring a computer programmer, and he was so quick to point out the language that Bill Wilson uses in 1939 and how far advanced it was for that time. Because we use the word program all the time, right? One of the definitions of a program, if you look it up in the dictionary, is a sequential set of instructions that brings about a result. Now think about it. Listen to the language. What do you do when you get a corrupt file on a computer today? Oh, you put in a recovery disk, right? And what's its function? It restores it to an earlier point in the process. Second step, right? Then he tells me that steps 10 and 11 are like the viral scan. And I didn't know what it went right over my head. I had no idea what he was talking about. It went right over my head. And the reason was, is because for 17 years, I'd confused the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous with the program. And I thought they were the same thing. I had no idea that when they said principles before personalities, they might actually mean program before fellowship. That Wilson saw that these things wouldn't always have an equal weight, although they should. And they are both equally important. See, the fellowship gives me enthusiasm. It gives me inspiration. It gives me encouragement. It gives me hope. Brotherly love, compassion, sympathy. Some people even get relationships and employment here, right? But if you put an alcoholic of my type into a large group of happy people like this, I seem to get sicker in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I find myself more separate, more different, and more alone. And what that means is separated from God. It means different than every single person here. That's what we call terminal uniqueness, if you haven't heard. And alone. You know that ache in the heart of every alcoholic that has nothing to do with the proximity or closeness of other people? It actually has to do with my inability to connect, right? And you put a couple of drinks in me, I'm calling people from fifth grade saying, I love you. I go right into amends. See, if you put liquor into me, all of a sudden I am at one with God. I am connected to every soul in this room, and I am at peace with self. And unless I can find that sense of comfort and ease that I sought from alcohol through this process, this spiritual way of life, a drunk like me will never stay here. I will always feel like I'm on the outside looking in. I will always have that sense of inadequacy, and I will always feel separate. And what I discover eventually through this process is by taking these simple, unrelated actions in Alcoholics Anonymous consistently over a period of time, I finally connect. That's why I think the three most important words in AA, and they don't come right away, are, yeah, me too. Real simple. Yeah, I felt like that too. Did I drink like Bill? Did I feel like Bill? Did I think like Bill? Very, very simple idea going through that chapter, which I thought at one time was the most boring thing in the world. And I started to really understand these ideas, that the whole book is separated into prayers, promises, warnings, and directions. And you can take four highlighters and go through the book and look at it that way. And all of a sudden it appealed to me in a completely different way. And when I look back at 17 years of failure, even in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, what I see in my life today is my defiance towards spiritual principles. The original manuscript said, rarely have we seen a person fail that's thoroughly followed our directions, right? Now, if you're like me, I don't like directions. I hate directions. I don't like being told not to do something I already don't want to do, right? I will argue with anybody about anything at any time. You tell me it's black, I'll tell you it's white. You tell me it's big, I'll tell you it's small. You tell me to go left, I'll go right with an attitude. Oh, and then I'll blame you for eternity. That's why we say denial's an acronym. It stands for don't even notice I am lying. Think about it. You could tell an alcoholic. You can't tell them much. Oh, you don't believe it? Try sponsoring somebody. And what that means is you can lead me into the gates of hell, but you can't push me into heaven. And when I finally understood when Wilson says attraction rather than promotion, that would ultimately mean that a drunk like me has to get to AA on my own terms. Not because sober living wants me to, not because my loving family wants me to, not because the judicial system wants me to, not because of the parole department, but really for me as an alcoholic to get to AA because I burned my life to the ground. And what I discovered is that for an alcoholic of my type, hope doesn't matter to me until I'm hopeless. Until I've got to that place of hopelessness, hope doesn't matter. You think hope matters to me when I got a brand new truck, a hot girlfriend, and a couple $100,000 in the bank? You think I need hope? And God doesn't matter to me until my back's against the wall. You know, I know what it's like to be on that gurney with the paramedics surrounding me with the little jumper cables, you know, the paddles. All I know is God. Right? When I'm puking my guts out with the dry heaves every morning, right? All I know is God. Who prays more than drugs like us? Come on. And I get a couple of days away from that drink, and my ego rebuilds to the point where you got to write this elaborate chapter called We Agnostics to try to prove to me through a series of ideas that there's a power in this universe other than me. Right? And what happens? I get to one more treatment center. Thank goodness we don't look like our stories, right? So I get to another treatment center. I'm 120 pounds. I stink like urine. I'm missing teeth. My fingers are dirty. And I'm dying. You know, a vision for you, right? And I'm sitting in this detox in my nightgown with my ass hanging out. You know, look like I just got out of a concentration camp. And I think I got it going on. And I'm judging the speaker, of course. We're the only people that actually can be on the curb and look down at the world. Right? I got two speeds, grandiose and comatose. And I'm strutting around this detox bragging about Robin Brink's trucks. I finally do my four-step. It was a bread truck. It was empty. So there I am in the detox, and this woman comes in on her H&I panel. Now, if you're not aware of H&I, it stands for hospitals and institutions. In some parts of the country, they call it corrections and treatment. But hospitals and institutions brings meetings into prisons, detoxes, treatment centers, hospitals, anywhere where clients, patients, or inmates can't get to meetings. I think H&I probably has the lowest relapse rate in all of recovery. Our H&I on the west side of L.A. is about 250 people. It's like this size. And they're fighting each other to get on panels to talk to people in treatment centers that don't care. So this woman's on her panel. She's doing her AA talk. And at the end of her talk, she looks us all up and down, and she says, if I could give you all the gift of recovery, I wouldn't do it. And I looked at her, and I looked at the guy next to me, and I said, what a bitch. And then she said something that would later change my life. She said, the reason I wouldn't give you the gift of recovery, the reason I wouldn't just give you that gift, is because I wouldn't rob you of the journey. And all of these years later, I've come to understand that that journey to recovery, just like that journey to surrender, that each and every one of us as an alcoholic has to walk is personal. And if you're new, we can't give it to you. We cannot give you that gift of desperation. And I could write all day long on step one until I'd beaten down that liquor store door at 5:59 a.m. over and over and over, or paid the clerk at 7-Eleven $100 for a six-pack, or driven all the way to Mexico to get at the bar, or done all the diabolical, despicable, disgusting things that many of us do, have to do on that journey to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. You think writing about step one was going to save me? I had to have a relationship with alcohol. I had to relinquish that idea. And then it got worse, right? And then I get to a place where my head can't get enough and my body can't take any more. And then I'm knocking on death's door. When my head can't get enough and my body can't take any more, God means something totally different to a drunk like me. It means grow or die. Then I got two choices, right? The same two choices, the same fork in the road that almost every single one of us get to. Go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of my intolerable situation. What's the other one? Oh, accept spiritual help. And then it implies these are not easy choices. I mean, if you were to do a survey at Costco, jails, institutions, and death, happy, joyous, and free. It's like a no-brainer, right? You step over to local detox, you find me, you ask me that question, and I'm thinking, how bad an alcoholic dad? Can I talk to my parole officer and my therapist? And I will minimize, justify, and rationalize that first string. It is critical that I see that. Now, I don't want to offend any of the new people, but as an example, you throw someone a life raft, they look at the life raft and they say, I was looking for a blue one. How do you work with a guy like that? Or, I don't like the way you threw it. I mean, in sponsorship, we hear this all the time. The yeah, but, and you don't understand, and my case is different. And it's like, it really gets down to these two choices. And, you know, there used to be a word called purgatory. We still use that word, but purgatory means to be caught between two worlds. And one world is, I can't live out there drunk anymore because it's too painful. But I can't live sober and happy because I'm unwilling to let go of some old ideas. So I live in God's waiting room in spiritual pain. And they say, if you want what we have. It's a very good question, and that's the turning point. And I couldn't see it. You know, Don and I were talking about where I grew up, and, you know, I'm in the south side of Chicago with a college degree and a soup line in the snow because I've been thrown out of the Salvation Army for being drunk again. And I don't understand that if you were to take the three relationships in my life, my relationship with God, plus my relationship with self, plus my relationship with others, if you were to put that on a blackboard and put an equal sign under it, you know what it would equal, right? Salvation Army. And what my sponsor and my home group challenged me to do was to set aside everything I thought I knew about God, about myself, and about others, and especially AA, so at any time I could have a brand new experience with this. This way of life, this design for living, this roadmap to spiritual success. And he asked me, he said, how free do you want to be? You want to be free enough to just survive this thing? Or do you want to be free enough to chase your dreams? To have relationships that work? To have a life with purpose? And that was a big challenge for me. Now, if you're new, by the way, we're the only people that actually want a reward because we ran out of a burning building. Right? I mean, think about it. If you're new and you're feeling heroic tonight because you sacrificed your big Saturday night to hang out with us, this is the only place on God's earth where they'll actually applaud because you came in to save your own life. Right? I mean, you're sitting here tonight thinking about drinking. That beats the hell out of being in some sleazy bar thinking about getting sober. Perspective. And you're in an AA meeting wondering when the miracle's going to happen. You're in an AA meeting on a Saturday night. The miracle's happened. I was told my sobriety is God's gift to me. What I do with my sobriety is my gift to God. That there was three prayers in this life. One is, God help me. Alcoholic prayer, isn't it? God help me. Second prayer, God give me. Greatest distraction on earth. But the prayer I never said was, God use me. And I end up out here in the middle of Georgia, and I couldn't be happier to be here. You know, there's people here. I met a lady that is from my home group in Santa Monica that knows all the meetings I go to. There's someone here that's been to all of them. And I bet you there's people here that this is their first roundup. And you can see the hope. You can see the love here. You can see that this way of life really works. People say there's no evidence-based results in AA. If anybody went to the Atlanta convention, how can the therapeutic community say AA has no evidence-based results after you see something like that? And Bill Wilson, I believe, was in Time magazine. He's being responsible for one of the largest social movements of the last century. It's affected the lives of somewhere between 30 to 40 million people worldwide. And you know why I don't think it's going to work for a drunk like me? Because it wasn't my idea. So if you're new, you might want to be a little open-minded. My sponsor said to me, he said, Adam, I want you to buy a black suit. And I said, why? And he said, well, you know, he got really serious. He said, you know, if you hang around AA, unfortunately, you're going to go to a lot of funerals. It'll come in handy. Then he laughed and he said, oh, and by the way, if you drink again, at least we'll have something nice to bury you in. And that's the truth. If you baby the alcoholic, you'll bury him. I need to hear the truth about alcoholism. It is fatal. It is progressive. It is chronic. We talk about jails, institutions of death. That's like hamburgers, fries, and a Coke, right? But see, I live in delusion. I am in full flight from reality. I cannot differentiate the true from the false. And I'm challenged as I go through these ideas in the book to see the truth. Now, I do a lot of H&I. I should, right? I'm an alumni from everywhere. And one of the H&I panels that we have a VA up where I live in Los Angeles, one of the biggest veterans administrations in the country. People come from all over the U.S. to go there because of the specials. But we do these AA panels in this treatment center, you know, in the VA. And you get into a room like this size, full of soldiers, and they ask us to pick a topic. So I'm a smartass. I pick surrender. Room gets dead quiet. Especially Marines, right? But as an illustration for the people that are new, if you ever watch a soldier surrender, like in a theater of combat, the illustration's perfect. You'll see the soldier take the rifle, very slowly lay it on the ground, sit down on the side of the road, wait for someone to tell them what to do, right? I mean, when you got 40 AK-47s at your, pointed at your head, you don't throw down the gun with an attitude. No offense to the newcomers, the court card people. You're not sitting on the side of the road looking back at the gun, because if you do, someone's going to shoot you. And as a newcomer, I have to ask myself, am I looking back at alcohol? Am I looking back at the magic that I once found in booze? It's like being in the high school gym 20 years later. The band's gone, the girls are gone, the lights are out. And I'm in this cold, dark, empty room saying, where's the party? There's no disco ball where I was drinking. See, but that's the euphoric recall. That's the peculiar mental twist. That is the lurking reservation that Bill Wilson talks about that precedes that first drink. And it's like life has its moments. And for those very moments, a drunk like me will give my life. And we've lost so many beautiful people that are smarter than me, more spiritual than me, but somehow unable to continue over a long period of time to see the truth, to see that insanity. And that's where I get to. You know, now going through treatment 28 times, I don't want to bash the therapeutic community. Like, I haven't done a good enough job. But, you know, I started to speak a foreign language in treatment. You guys know what it is, right? It's called victimese. I don't understand how the drink bone connects to the jail bone. Right? I need a class for that, right? Part of the relapse prevention curriculum. It's kind of like I met her in rehab. I can't believe she drank. If you haven't wrote inventory, I understand. Knew he was a crackhead. Can't believe he stole my iPhone. Oh, you had that happen? Probably took your whole truck. Probably robbed your house. But see, the book talks about how I make decisions based on self that later leave me in a position to be hurt. And if I do not connect those dots through the process of inventory, somehow I continue to play victim. Victims don't stay sober. And as I go through those considerations carefully, what I see is I will invariably paint those red flags green. And I had to go back through my life. What I never understood about Alcoholics Anonymous until much later is it would demand responsibility. Even the dollar isn't about the dollar. It's about the spiritual responsibility of me being there for my own recovery and responsible for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never understood that. And I continue to do that inventory to this day, to watch in 10, to do a nightly review. And my friend says, why do you keep doing that? And he likened it to going to an ATM machine. Now, this may be a peculiar analogy, but when you go to the ATM machine, what do? You put in the card, put in the code, take the money, right? Put in the card, put in the code, take the money. And after a while, you have this epiphany, this awareness, you stop doing it. You withdraw from this spiritual process. And he says, do you realize what's going on behind the wall? I said, no. He said, the account's being debited. And what happens as I continue to take inventory is eventually I become emotionally separated from the events that used to own me. It never occurred to me that resentment was about attachment, and that attachment caused me spiritual pain. And if I didn't continue to go through that process, I would never have the awareness and the freedom. See, alcoholism really is the only prison where the key's inside. And although there is mechanics in the steps, it is a spiritual process. And part of the word spiritual is ritual. And a lot of the things that we do in this ritual, like go to meetings, work steps, help others, maintain commitments, be of service, over a period of time, bring about a shift in my perception. It's almost like normal people are intellect over emotion. They think, they process, and they act, right? I'm exactly the opposite. I'm emotion over intellect. I act, process, and then think. Oops, 10th step. Oh, come on. We're the only people that burn bridges ahead of us. You're laughing. You're relating. That's not good. So the book talks about unless I can experience an entire psychic change, very little hope of my recovery. But again, the question is, how free do I want to be? And I never understood the freedom that was available here until I became willing to take these actions, until I became willing to set aside my old ideas. And it was all based on this idea of surrender. For me, there's a direct relationship between surrender and willingness. You ever notice you'll never see anybody more willing to work the AA program than the guy that comes crawling in a meeting after a long, hard run? Right? We all see him. First day out of detox, he's got three sponsors. Wants to take the whole coffee pot home with him. Doesn't even have a trunk to put it in, right? It's how we lose half our literature. And then 30, 60, 90 days later, I'm looking at this sponsor saying, you mean we got to go to meetings every day? And like a prize fighter, I throw in that towel, and then I take that towel back one little piece at a time. Don and I were talking about, you know, taking people through the process, going through the steps. And my friend said, you know, you're going to become an expert at the doctor's opinion. I said, what does that mean? He says, well, you go through the doctor's opinion with a new guy. By the time you get to Bill's story, he's met the love of his life. By the time you get to there is a solution, he's got a new career. And by more about alcoholism, he doesn't need AA. And that seems to be the exact scenario that I went through over and over and over again. That what I would do is I would build Alcoholics Anonymous around my big life. And as my life gets bigger, the beautiful girl, the big car, the nice home, that great job. You know what happens to AA? It becomes really inconvenient. And what I've had to do in order to actually stay in Alcoholics Anonymous and grow and thrive is I've had to build my life around AA. And a lot of us have had that same experience. It's like the difference between being in the program and on the program. I think it's the same thing. My sponsor said it's kind of like being in a submarine or on a submarine. Now, when the ship takes a dive, you'll find out if you're in it or on it. And the book talks about that. It says, if I fail to enlarge and perfect my spiritual life, I will not survive the certain low spots ahead. And I guarantee you they come. The broken heart, the ruined business, the stock market crash. They happen. And my friend said, you know, you can fall off the edge, you can't fall off the middle. And I was taught to stay in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous because it would insure me. Insurance. Very, very simple idea. And I know for me as an alcoholic, there's a big difference between the act of surrender that got me into AA as a newcomer, right, every time I had a new crisis, and the state of surrender that's keeping the old-timers here. And it's a completely different concept. It's kind of like watching a swan glide across a pond of still water. It's so beautiful, so effortless, right? It's so graceful. But you know what that little bird's doing under the water, right? He's paddling like hell. And if you're new, we have a chapter in the big book, Into Action. You ever notice there's no chapter into feelings? I know the therapists hate it when I say that. Into thinking. Right? We ought to have a chapter into whining from the podium. I'm like, get a job, please. And again, I became willing to take actions in Alcoholics Anonymous that I didn't believe. And I was told that that triangle, recovery, unity, and service that we talk about so often really translates into three actions. Contribute, belong, and learn. Contributing is service. It makes me feel needed. Belonging is unity. It makes me feel wanted. To learn is to uncover, discover, and discard the things that are blocking me. And the product of those three actions over time is I find wisdom, power, and love. The steps bring me wisdom. The fellowship brings me power where two or more are gathered, and by reaching back in my community and helping another drunk, I find love. It is through that compassion that I see this thing called intimacy, which is into me I see. I see myself. And that goes back to, yeah, me too. That very simple idea, right? There's a therapy called cognitive behavioral therapy, right? Expensive. In AA, it's one sentence. You can't think your way into right living, but you can live your way into right thinking. So I continue to take these actions. You know, it's like the old-timer and the newcomer see that light at the end of the tunnel, right? The old-timer knows that's hope. The newcomer thinks it's an oncoming freight train. And they'll tell you, oh, time doesn't matter. I'm like, really? Get some. Right? I know that's what they told me. I don't want to like offend anybody, but the old timers used to say, you know, if you don't like the old timers in AA, don't worry about it. You'll never be one. They were so mean, right? But see, at the VA, they say it. Why would you go through an uncharted minefield without a guide? And the old timers in Alcoholics Anonymous have that experience, strength, and hope. They have that hard-won experience. Great story about these two old-timers and a newcomer on this rowboat, and they're going out fishing. I'm sure some of you have heard this. And one of the old-timers realizes he gets off the shore that he's left his cigarettes on the shore. So he very carefully tiptoes out of the boat, and he grabs his cigarettes and gets back in the boat. And a couple minutes later, the older old-timer wants to get some bait, so he steps out of the boat very carefully, picks up his bait. Newcomer's watching this, so he jumps out of the boat to get his cigarettes, and he drowns. And the old-timers look at each other and they go, gosh, I wish he'd stayed around long enough so we could have showed him where the rocks were. But time doesn't matter, right? I think it does. And I'm so lucky that I got around old-timers in AA that had that wisdom. You know, and I will be forever grateful because it's like it just perpetuates over time. We've been doing the same thing since 1935 when Bill met Bob. You know, and if you're like me, see, fear's not going to keep me sober. I don't know about you guys, but getting a third strike, living on the street, being homeless, losing my career, throwing away my education, did scared straight work for you all? It went right over my head. Now, the book talks about the problem drinker, right? It actually illustrates the problem drinker as someone that can stop or moderate given sufficient reason. Big difference between a problem drinker and a real alcoholic. Think about it. You get a problem drinker and a real alcoholic in a jail cell, you know, the rubber room for drunk driving. You got two completely different philosophies going on. You got the problem drinker over here on one side of the cell thinking, why'd I drink so much last night? I knew I shouldn't have drank so much. Real alcoholics on the other side of the cell thinking, why'd I take Interstate 75? See, now the court card people don't think that's funny either. Right? You should have stayed on Surface Street. You could have been home cleaning your pipe tonight. Problem drinker's wife says, if you don't stop drinking, I'm leaving you. Problem drinker cleans up his act, does a drink in the house, gets a little Visine. Now, if my woman says, honey, if you don't stop drinking, I'm leaving you. You know what I'm thinking, right? I'm thinking about single life. See, if anything gets in the way of my drinking, it's out of my life. Alcohol was the love of my life. It had me from hello. It completed me, right? You think I'm going to let go of the love of my life without a fight? I can't even let go of a bad relationship. Yeah. Everything I let go of has claw marks all over it. And if you're new, my relationship now with Alcoholics Anonymous has become the same. If anything gets in the way of Alcoholics Anonymous for this drunk, it's out of my life. A woman, I don't care how beautiful she is, how in love we are. I remember the first time I said that in a meeting, there she was in the back of the room. She's like, oh, honey, why do you got to go to all those meetings? Then she tells me, you know, you're not speaking again this weekend, are you? Then it was, you know, that AA program's getting in the way of our relationship. So a couple months later, we're still dating. It's getting a little heavier. Now it's the big night. You know the big night, right? Meet the parents night. So she gets me a suit and tie, props me up, head of the table, at her parents' house for dinner. Out comes the exotic wine. She's like, you can have one glass of wine. Oh, please, it's just a glass of wine, honey. Just a glass. It's a toast. It's natural wine. Four more rehabs. I stole her purse that night. Went down to the hood and got an outside issue. And she came to detox with a get well card. I know, I think I got four cards from that one. Poor girl. I tried to send her to Codependence Anonymous. She didn't want to go. She didn't have anyone to go with. I can always tell the Al-Anons in the crowd, they don't think any of this is funny. I'm sorry. Call your sponsor. Can't stand to see us have a good time even here. So the truth is I come from a long line of suicide, mental illness, and alcoholism. My mother's brother committed suicide drunk. My father's brother committed suicide drunk. And I'm coming out of treatment, and they're looking at me saying, what, are you better than us now because you don't drink? And the problem with Alcoholics Anonymous is we all know it's full of alcoholics, right? So if I don't understand Al-Anon, I don't understand that this is a systemic family disease. I don't understand the causes and congestions, my need to play God, and start to really understand I didn't cause it, I can't control it, I can't cure it, and start to understand these simple ideas. There is very little chance that I'm going to have long-term relationships with anybody. And I learn how to mind my own business. I learn to have some business mind. And I start to take the traditions off the wall and I start to apply them to my family and my relationship. That our common welfare comes first. Our relationship depends on our unity, right? For our relationship's purpose, there is a loving God as He expresses Himself in our relationship. The only requirement to stay in this relationship is a desire to be together, and so forth and so on, with a little adjustment in the wording for a relationship, right? Or for a business, even for humanity. If you really look at these ideas, how amazing and well-written they were, and how much Bill Wilson saw the future of Alcoholics Anonymous and how it ensures our survival. But even as a relationship, when we talk about autonomy in the fourth tradition, the opposite of autonomy is codependence. Intimacy is not two people looking at each other. It's two people playing different instruments to the same music and looking at a common goal. And I understand now what autonomy is. And what happened to me is I started to apply these principles in my life. You know how many Al-Anons it takes to screw in a light bulb? None. The Al-Anon detaches and lets it screw itself. Now, that's easy to say, but when one of your loved ones is dying of alcoholism, it is so hard to not be an enabler. It's so hard to detach. And I know how serious this is, as much as there's levity about it, because of the family system that I came out of. And you know what? My mom that didn't move, and she moved and left the forwarding address, as I said. What happened is I was the weakest link in my family. And eventually, over a period of time, I became the strongest link in that family. Eventually, over a period of time, I became my mom's best friend. Over a period of time, you know, I took her to doctors and wheelchair rides and museums, and we became the best of friends because of Alcoholics Anonymous. But there was something else I had to understand, and a lot of us know this. The reason our families push our buttons, you know why, right? Because they install them. But one of the things that Alcoholics Anonymous does over a period of time is it shows me that button. It also shows me how to be rid of those ideas. And I go through these considerations over a period of time in the steps. I was asked, when it says we realize the people who offended us were also perhaps spiritually sick, and then it says, although we did not like their symptoms, which is column 2, or the way it disturbed us, column 3, like ourselves were sick too. I was asked to look at every resentment I had and see if I was capable of the same behavior under the same circumstances. So if I resent an employer for exploiting me, did I ever exploit an employer? If I resent a friend for gossiping, did I ever gossip? If I resented one of my parents for emotionally abandoning me, did I ever emotionally abandon anyone because of my alcoholism? See, forgiveness is releasing someone from the prison of my own mind, but it also means to realize that I was the prisoner. And I get to the delusion in that inventory and I realize that the lie I told myself was my parents' love for me was more powerful than their alcoholism. That's why I was in so much pain. And once I was able to see that, I got free of it. You know, my dad was never there for me as a kid. And me and him are best friends today. And they say life on life's terms. That's like an eye for an eye, but I believe in life on God's terms. I believe in taking the higher road. And what I was taught to do was to be his best friend and act as if. And one day he looks at me and he says, I'm so sorry I wasn't there for you when you were a little boy. And God, I just healed like that. It was like I healed immediately. I know this may not be true for everybody. Some people have very toxic relationships. But for me, that was what happened. And I discovered also that if people have to change for me to be happy, what kind of life am I going to have? So how do I learn to be happy in a dysfunctional family, in a dysfunctional community, or a dysfunctional country? How do I learn to be happy? To not be that Florida businessman, like it says in the book, laying in the sunshine complaining about the state of the nation, right? How easy it is to do that, especially right now. And how that will squander the hours of my life that might be worthwhile. And how important these things are for people that think like I do. So I sponsor guys that pay more in taxes than I do. I earn all year. They have these huge careers, these little tiny programs. I've never seen one of them stand the test of time here. What do I do for a living? I stay sober. Oh, what do I do for money? That's over there. I get those two things mixed up. I'm back in handcuffs. I get those two things mixed up. I'm back in an emergency room. Or I get a doubleheader. I'm handcuffed to a gurney in an emergency room. If you're new, puke smells the same in a Mercedes. Some deep thought goes into that, trust me. And the deep thought is, I will never, ever, ever solve a spiritual problem with a physical solution. And unless I really understand what the problem is, the solution will not work. And part of the problem for me as an alcoholic is very much described in the chapter 5 that we read all the time, where it says our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas, right? A, that I'm an alcoholic and I cannot manage my own life. B, that probably no human power can relieve my alcoholism and what that really means. And C, that God could and would have sought. And I'm thinking, before and after what? What the heck are they talking about? But for me as an alcoholic, it's before and after I stop drinking. See, a lot of people think that the unmanageability in the second half of step one is because of drinking. If alcohol's the problem, the solution is abstinence. But everything in my book and everything in my life indicates there is something much deeper. A deeper spiritual maladjustment that drives me back to the obsession. The obsession moves me into the allergy, and the allergy kills me. And the doctor's opinion is really clear. It talks about some of us are entirely normal in every respect except the effect produced by alcohol. That's not who I am. It talks about another type there, right? A restless type. We have a new word for it. What's restless? Oh, it's ADD. But what it means is I have a spirit that's undisciplined. I have an undisciplined spirit. Someone was talking about herding cats. It's a lot like that. And it is treated over a long period of time with the 11th step. I have an irritability, which means I'm quick to anger, I'm slow to forgive. You know when you're on the phone with AT&T? Right? You're counting their items in the checkout line. They got 11. Chasing you four exits past my exit on the freeway, right? See, the irritability, the keeping score in every single relationship that I'm in, right? I remember everything I should forget. I forget everything I should remember. It's treated with the 10th step. And the discontentment, it means the shine wears off everything right away. It doesn't matter what I get. I got a brand new car. I've been saving all year for this car. I don't even get it off the lot. It's the wrong color. I don't like the color. I get a new house. I'm not even out of escrow. I hate the neighbors. Hate them. I didn't know they had a dog. 30 years. I get a new job. I'm making more money than I've ever made in my life. I sit down in the office. I'm doing the math. I'm getting ripped off. And you wonder why relationships are difficult? Harry Tebow says, alcoholics are grandiose, sensitive, immature, and omnipotent, and those are our finer qualities. Why don't you put that in your next personal ad? So I start to see how I need to even watch for those four, the grandiosity and how it'll separate me from people. The emotional immaturity, the omnipotence, which is the need to play God. And I start to see that there's something much deeper, a spiritual maladjustment. And it's so interesting because a lot of guys I drank with, as soon as they stop drinking, everything works for them. They fit in, they're part of, the career welcomes them back, they come to meetings once a year, never work a step, and their life gets continually better. They've been serene since their ass hit the seat in AA. It's not my experience. My experience, every time I stop drinking, the first thing they say to me is, "You really need to be on medication. Why are you so angry? Why are you so emotional? Why can't you sit still back there? What's wrong with you?" And I'm crying at dog food commercials. See, when I'm not drinking, I have a whole other set of problems. And they're outlined on page 52 of the big book. When I'm not drinking, I'm a prey to misery and depression. When I'm not drinking, I can't control my emotional nature, right? When I'm not drinking, I can't manage my personal relationships. Sound familiar? When I'm not drinking, I'm full of fear. When I'm not drinking, I'm basically unhappy. And the way that plays out for me in untreated alcoholism is I don't fit in, I'm not part of, you don't understand me, everybody's in my way, life's not fair, they're not treating me right, they're not paying me enough, for goodness sake, I gotta drink. And as soon as I pick up a cocktail, I intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle me. Right? Three or four more drinks, fear of people and economic insecurity leave me, I'm buying the whole bar drinks. Hell, I'll write you a check. Not only are you getting better looking, honey, I'm getting better looking. Right? Give me a couple of Vicodin, I could comprehend the word serenity and I know peace. Little cocaine, I want to start a business with you. Now, if you're laughing at that, there's something really wrong with you guys. See, that doesn't occur in the normal or temperate drinker. Alcohol is classified as a depressant. 9 out of 10 people, they have a couple drinks and they say, whoa, I got to slow down. I'm feeling it. I have a couple drinks and honey, I want to get married. I want to go to Vegas tonight. I'm trying to find the car keys I hid for myself before the first drink. So for me, alcohol is a stimulant. And that's what the earth people don't understand about us. Alcohol does so much for me, I don't care what it's doing to me. So unless I really understand what the problem is, the solution's not going to work. And part of the problem for an alcoholic of my type is when I stop drinking, the outsides get better, but the insides get worse. And the longest bridge that I will ever cross, the longest journey that I will ever walk as an alcoholic in recovery, is that little dash between the first and second half of step one. It's telling me I got a body that can't process alcohol, but more importantly, I have a mind that cannot process reality, not to my liking. So I got a body that can't drink and a mind that has to? You don't think that's a dilemma? And that's what the Al-Anons can't figure out about us. They can't figure out why we drink. We can't figure out why you don't. Well, now you know. And I thought for years, because I drink, therefore my life's unmanageable. That's just a half-truth. That's like looking at the tip of an iceberg and seeing the ruined marriage, broken home, financial destitution, the failing health, and thinking that's the problem. In fact, that's what treatment tells me the problem is. That's why I'm sitting in some fancy treatment center in a nightgown learning about my triggers. And I'm like, counselor, excuse me, counselor, waking up's a trigger for me, I'm awake. It's like, sir, will you please go back to your dorm and button up your nightgown? And I'm back on Skid Row, drooling on myself, reciting chapter 5 out of the big book. And the bum next to me is like, will you shut up? You're ruining my high. And I'm crying because I can't get back here. Because I got a head full of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got a belly full of booze, and I'm separate, different, and alone one more time. And if you think that's painful, you know what could actually be worse than that? Being in this room tonight, being a real alcoholic, and not working the 12 steps. It could almost be more painful. Coming to meetings late, leaving early, not having a sponsor, not having commitments, not being connected, doing the work. You have no anesthetic. It's almost worse. That's why we should have a moment of recognition. You know, we always do 30, 60, 90 days. We have chips. Maybe we should have a moment of recognition for the person in their last 30 days. You can always spot them. Just ask them how they're doing. I'm fine. I'm like, really? Why don't you tell your face that? But we always hear about him later. You know, remember so-and-so? He shot himself. Went back to prison. Overdosed. See, I know what it's like to be in my last 30 days. I know what it's like to... sit in a room full of happy people like this and feel spiritually disconnected. That ache that we talk about, that inability to connect. And all of my life, I was one decision away from a drink. And today, between me and that decision, there is a deep and effective spiritual experience. There is people like you. There's rooms like this. There is this power, this process, and this program that sits between it. And when I'm having a bad day, maybe I need a meeting. When I'm having a great day, a meeting needs me. You know, people ask me at 19 years why I still go to meetings. I'm like, why do you keep going to the gas station? Because the shower I took yesterday won't keep me clean today. When Wilson says we cannot rest on our laurels, the word laurel means past accomplishment. It's like unplugging a refrigerator. You unplug a refrigerator, everything goes bad. And what I found is when I stay plugged into this spiritual way of life, my life works. I'm able to navigate around the drama. I'm able to match calamity with serenity. I'm able to stay in fit spiritual condition. So I start to understand what the greater problem is. And part of that problem for me when I stop drinking is I have this need to play God. That's the omnipotence. The actor trying to be the director, trying to arrange my relationship, my career, my family, if they would only do as I wished, right? So I have this need to play God. The actor trying to be the director. And what I also do is give God a role in my play. And when God doesn't meet my finite human expectations, consciously or subconsciously, I become separated from that power. One of the things they said to Michelangelo, he said, how did you make the statue of David? And Michelangelo said, I never made the statue of David. I just chipped away everything that wasn't David, and there he was. And in many ways, the process of going through the 12 steps will show me the things that are blocking me. It's kind of like telling a 5-year-old kid, go in your room and straighten out your room. He doesn't want to do it. You tell that same little kid, go in your room, throw out all your old stuff, we'll buy you new stuff. How long would that take? So what if it was really true that these old ideas were blocking me? So this need to be right, this need to sort, compare, judge, and label, this attachment that I have, because that's what resentment is. I've taken an event from my past, I've attached emotion to it, and then I refeel it, I relive it, I reenact it in every area of my life. My life is like Groundhog Day. I have a severe emotional overreaction. You know the book says I'm driven by 100 forms of fear? When I go through that third column, they come out for me to be 5 basic ideas. Abandonment, rejection, betrayal, disrespect, and authority. And every one of those is driven by fear. Fear of abandonment. Isn't that the relationship one, right? Fear of betrayal. I need to have her passcodes. Fear of disrespect. More people get killed behind disrespect than all of them. Fear of rejection. I'm never going to try anything new. And fear of authority. It is a faulty relationship with God based on self-reliance. And as I go through those ideas, the first thing I discover is that I will never solve a spiritual problem with a physical solution. But that's my need. We were talking about sitcoms earlier. Does anybody remember Gilligan's Island? Did you ever notice that Gilligan's Island was a 7 deadly sins? Think about it. And if you're too young, go to Hulu. But the captain was gluttony, Gilligan was sloth, Marianne was envy, Ginger was lust, Mr. Howe was greed, the professor was pride. I would have killed everyone on the island but Ginger. No, maybe I would have kept Marianne around for a little drama. But if you really look at those ideas, as I take these ideas and I put them into my real life, what I do is I take that drink and I put it down and I pick up the fork. Then I'm naked in the mirror in step 6 and 7 saying, I can't live like this. Back to God. I ask God, please remove this. I put down the fork and I pick up the credit card, right? Now I'm going to fix what I did with the fork with the credit card. I'm in liposuction. Buying clothes. Then I'm on my knees in step 6 and 7 in bankruptcy court. Saying, God, please take this from me. Then I put down the credit card, start acting out in the rooms. Can't go to that meeting again. And what I start to see is how easy it is for me to play musical poisons in the first half of step one and never really address the problem. And one of the things the book talks about is when I straighten out spiritually, only then will I straighten out mentally and physically. I mean, how can I plant corn and harvest potatoes? That seems so obvious. But I want to plant selfishness and dishonesty and resentment and fear in every area of my life and harvest unconditional love and joy. And it doesn't add up. One of the things my sponsor said to me, he said, Adam, what do you want from AA? You keep recycling through the rooms over and over and over again. And we were talking before the meeting. You know, I grew up in Malibu. After I moved from Chicago, I'm in Malibu. All I want is a yacht and a Learjet. You know what I mean? I have this ego and this pride, and that's what I see around me. And you know what my sponsor said to me? He said, if you work steps 4 through 9 and you consistently live in 10, 11, and 12, what you'll get, because I'm a taker, I'm actually here to get something. He says, what you'll get is a quiet mind and a loving heart. And I remember looking at him and thinking, what do I want that for? But see, if you have a mind like mine, I start to look at the opposite of a quiet mind. It's a mind that won't shut up. Right? It's that irritability that's treated by the 10th step. It's up 5 minutes before me every day saying, you don't need AA. And the opposite of a loving heart is a vindictive heart. It's a prejudiced heart. It's a racist heart. And all of my life, I've been crucified between two thieves. Yesterday and tomorrow. And yesterday I have guilt, shame, and remorse. And tomorrow I have fear, anxiety, and worry. And as I continue to process through the steps, just like that analogy of the 10th step, if I continue, what happens is eventually I get a quiet mind and a loving heart. Our spirits are like a body of water. When they're perfectly still, they best reflect the heavens. I know how to get there with a bottle of liquor. But unless I can find that sense of comfort and ease that I'm seeking from alcohol through this process, a drunk like me will never stay here. If you take alcohol away from me, you have to give me something better. And my experience is that's what AA is all about. If someone did to me what I did to myself, I know this may be rude, but you know what? I would have killed them, right? If someone had done to me what I did to myself, I would have killed them. If someone did to me what I did to others, I would have killed them. And then I come to AA and you want me to pray to God? I didn't want God to find out where I was. I'd become bankrupt in those very simple relationships. When I look back at the steps really remedy those three relationships. Steps 1 through 3, recreate and develop a relationship with God. Steps 4 through 7, recreate and develop a relationship with self. Steps 8 and 9, recreate and develop a relationship with others. Very simple idea. 10 maintains, develops, and grows my relationship with self. 11 maintains, develops, and grows my relationship with God. 12 through service maintains, develops, and grows my relationship with others. So coming out of the steps, for the first time in my life, not only am I easily able to control my desire for alcohol, because that's huge, but I'm able to live in harmony with God, self, and others. There was a great spiritual teacher. He was asked, what's the most important thing of all your teachings? What did he say? Love God with all thy heart. Love thy neighbor as thyself. And if God scares you out of AA and you're a real drunk, don't worry about it. Booze will scare you back in. Einstein said, I would rather live my life pretending there's a God and finding out there isn't than live my life pretending there's no God and finding out there is. That simple idea where it says, let the record speak for itself, and we agnostics, there's no chapter we believers. So I go through this process, sometimes blindly. But the results of this process are remarkable. So in 1 through 3, I give it up. 4 through 7, I clean it up. 8 and 9, I make it up. 10, 11, and 12, I keep it up. One of the things that happened to me, and I'll close with a couple of these things. When I got out of that 28th treatment center, the guy that was running the detox said, why don't you come back to detox next week and tell everybody in the detox how you stayed sober a whole week, if you can make it. And of course, the way he said it, I had a resentment. So for the next 8 years, I'm sitting in 2.5 hours of bumper-to-bumper traffic all the way across L.A. County to tell a bunch of strangers in detox how I stayed sober another week. And I was tricked into service. And you know what? Later, when I started taking guys through the doctor's opinion, it occurred to me that when Bill Wilson went through his third treatment, center. He gets this idea. Maybe if I go back and talk to some of the patients. And he calls Dr. Silkworth and he says, I've got this idea. I want to come back and talk to the patients. And Silkworth's like, you want to do what? He says, with some misgiving, he allowed him to do it. And what Dr. Silkworth saw from 1935 to 1939, he said was absolutely amazing. And you look at the credentials in the book, the Laster Award, Dr. Harry Thiebaud, Carl Jung, where he says ideas, attitudes, and emotions that are once the guiding force are suddenly cast to one side. What an amazing thing if you're new that you've tapped into, if you can find someone to take you through the book and find out what's at the other end of this. The freedom and the joy that you'll have, plus the fellowship, the common solution. The fellowship is but one element in the powerful cement that binds us. I'll finish with this last thing. Oldest story in AA is about this little five-year-old kid, and he says to his dad, can we play? The kid wants to play with the dad. The dad's like an accountant. He's trying to occupy this little five-year-old boy. So what he does is he gets a map of the world. You know how National Geographic, they have those great world maps, and he rips this map up into like 50 pieces, and he gives it to his little boy, and he gives his son some tape, and he says, what I want you to do is I want you to put this map of the world back together, and when you're done, we'll play. And he thinks it's going to take the kid an hour. Little five-year-old comes back in 2 minutes. He's got the whole map put back together. The dad's like, that's impossible. I'm like 50 years old. I couldn't do it. How'd you do it? And the little boy is so excited. He says, well, Dad, on the back of the map of the world, there was a picture of a man. I just put the man back together, and the whole world fell into place. And if you're new, that's really the spiritual technology of the 12 steps to rebuild the man or woman. 1 through 3 with God, 4 through 7 with self, through inventory, 8 and 9 with others, through amends, and then to maintain, develop, and grow those relationships. Don, thank you so much. Lots of love to all of you. Thank you.